Good afternoon, and welcome to the Elliott Bagel Company. It's my pleasure this afternoon to welcome with us Michael McCluskey. He's the recently retired chairman of the Sierra Club. In addition, he's a trustee for the Sierra Club. He recently served as president of the Federation of Western Outdoor Clubs. He has been recognized by such organizations as the UN Environmental Program, Natural Resources Council of America, and the Wild Foundation. He's also the recipient of several commendations for his work, environmental work. He's here this afternoon to give us an insider's look at the environmental movement, in particular, the Sierra Club. He got involved in environmental work way back in 1961. I was 4 years old when he started this. So he's here this afternoon with his book, In the Thick of It, My Life in the Sierra Club. Please welcome Michael McCluskey.
Thank you. It's delightful to be at the famous Elliott Bay bookstore, and I've been a customer in the past, and it's very good, I might say, to be living back in the Pacific Northwest again. I was gone for a number of years, a number of decades, in fact, but we're living in Portland now. And I'd like to thank all of you for coming here tonight and showing interest in my book. I'd like to introduce my wife, Maxine, who's sitting there. She was the one who urged me to write this book.
Well, you will note that he said urged and not nagged.
Well, I was paid to represent the Sierra Club for some 40 years, from 1960 until the year 2000. And this book is the story of my experiences working for four decades for the Sierra Club. Let me mention some of the highlights of my time with the Sierra Club. And I'll read a passage dealing with the North Cascades a little later in this presentation, but I did do some of the work that laid the foundations for the National Park and the North Cascades that now exists. I helped do some of the field work and political organizing that led to the establishment of a number of wilderness areas in the Northwest. In 1963, I was sent to Western Colorado and did the organizing that I think broke the bottleneck that stood in the way of the enactment of the Wilderness Act. And I'll read a passage from the book dealing with that, too. I was the chief lobbyist for the establishment of the Redwood National Park. There was later a second round in that legislation, which I oversaw, though I didn't do that in a hands-on sense. I also was the person who instigated the line of litigation that went to the Supreme Court of the United States that resulted in a decision which changed the rules for standing, that is, the rules that determine who gets to have their cases be heard by a court, and that allowed environmentalists to bring lawsuits. And of course, you know, there's been a huge amount of that through the years. You can blame me if you want. I think they were positive, by and large. I also oversaw a campaign that ran for well over a decade to add a key unit to Sequoia National Park in California in the Sierra, the Mineral King area. A lot of other people did hands-on work at the beginning and other parts in the end, the middle and the end, but I was the person overseeing that and helped strategizing through the whole period, resulting in that success. Over my career, I testified dozens of times before committees of Congress. For instance, I gave the lead testimony in the Senate for the when Scoop Jackson's bill for the establishment of the National Environmental Policy Act moved through. I kicked off the process there of public witnesses. And as both conservation director and executive director of the Sierra Club, I oversaw the Sierra Club's campaigns at the federal level that led to the establishment of, or I should say, to the passage of over 100 pieces of environmental legislation, some of them of fundamental significance. Obviously, many, many other people made major contributions in that process, but I was the person overseeing the entire process. However, in my career, in the time I spent with the Sierra Club, I was privileged to often be on the ground floor of various developments. For instance, I was the Sierra Club's first field organizer, field representative. I was its first conservation director. I was its first chief of staff. I was its first chairman. I was not its first executive director. I was its second. But I'm the only person to have been executive director on two occasions. When the person who followed me didn't work out, they brought me back for a little while. So I had the interesting experience of being back in that role a second time. And I served in that role for as long as anybody has. In sum, I was an executive of the Sierra Club for over 30 years. However, things did not always work out the way I had anticipated. Let me share a few anecdotes with you about that. Once in the late 1960s, when I was conservation director, I was working with many others in the effort to defeat dams in the Grand Canyon. And some volunteers in Southern California at a think tank had gone over the calculations behind the rationale for the dams in the canyon and the Central Arizona Project, and they thought they had found flaws in those calculations, and so some of them were economists. And so I ran out to Washington to meet, we'd arranged to meet with representatives for the then noted political columnist, Drew Pearson. And so I found myself in the bar of the Mayflower Hotel one night, meeting with him, and then there I was breathlessly telling him all that we had discovered and being very proud of it. And of course, when I went in there, the lights were very dim and I could hardly see who was around me. And suddenly, as my eyes adjusted to this light, with great consternation, I realized the person sitting next to me on the banquet there was none other than the senior Republican senator from the state of Arizona, the very last person on earth I wanted to alert that I was planting a story with Drew Pearson. I didn't want him to rebut it, you know. He'd have turned to him and say, but on the other hand. But he didn't. I quickly changed the subject and was about to slink away to another corner of the with my friend, and suddenly I took a second look at him, and I realized that there wasn't a flicker of recognition that he had heard what we were talking about. I think, frankly, he was too deep in his cups to know what was going on. That may have been true on more than one occasion, but I did learn a valuable lesson then, which was that there are ears everywhere in Washington. You have to be exceedingly careful about being overheard. For instance, on one occasion, the situation was reversed. I was going to Capitol Hill, again, to lobby on that subject, and it was a bad rainstorm, and the cabbie said, do you mind sharing the cab with somebody else? And I said, no, that's fine. So he stopped, and three guys got in, and as we proceeded on the way, suddenly I started tuning in on what these fellows were talking about. It was all the Central Arizona Project, and they were lobbyists on the other side. So I listened to it with great intensity, trying to record in my mind everything they were saying. And so when we didn't say a word, I didn't tip them off to who I was. I was their opposition. So when I got up to Capitol Hill, I trotted immediately over to our offices and told our staff everything I'd heard. And we got valuable insights into what we were facing. And there are many other stories in this vein, some of which are in my book. Well, another story that deals with the perils of strong drink. This was now in the early 70s. The Sierra Club was opposing the nomination of, did this rather routinely for a while, of various people to be Secretary of the Interior. I can't remember whether it was Jim Watt or somebody else, but we decided we were against him for good and sufficient reasons, and I wanted to plant a series of what I hoped would be revealing questions so that a friendly senator would ask these of the secretary-designate, and I thought I had very cleverly designed them so that each question would build on what was learned in the prior question, and it would build to a great climax. So I found the friendly senator, and after work, the day before, I took him out for a few drinks after work, and I gave him my list, and we had an amiable time, and I think he had quite a few drinks after work, relaxing, and I think he firmly got it in his mind that these questions had some connection to me. So the next morning came, and the secretary-designate testified, and I was then ready to see my marvelous questions get asked. But they weren't. The senator was silent, or at least as far as my questions were concerned. And so it came time for the public witnesses, and I was one of them, and I testified. And when I was through, suddenly my senator woke up. I mean, this is when I had... And he said, "Now, Mr. McCloskey, I'm going to ask you some questions." And they were all my own questions. And I kept saying, "Well, Senator, that is a very good question, but I think it would be better asked of the secretary-designate. He's the person who would know that." He said, "All right. Now, the next question is, doggedly going down this list. Talk about being hoisted on your own petard and being too clever by half." It was a complete fiasco. Well, let me tell you one more story. Once in the late 70s, I think it was, Sierra Club chapter in Palo Alto decided to have a reception for me. And I went down there, and it was all very nice, and I was shaking hands and chatting around with folks, and suddenly a little old lady came up to me and said, "Mr. McCloskey, I so admire you," and she went on and on about how great a person I was. I was doing all these fine things, and I was just taking this all in and thinking, this is great. I didn't know I had people who felt quite that deeply. And then finally she concluded by saying, "And I vote for you every time." And certainly it was clear to me, she wasn't talking about me at all. She was talking about their then Republican Congressman, Paul McCloskey. So I decided not to abuse the dear lady, and I said, "Well, just keep it up, that's fine." He was a good environmentalist, and I knew him, and so that was fine. And there are other stories in the book here about Pete McCloskey and confusion with our family. Turning now a little bit to the writing of the book, you know, at the time I was living through all of this, and particularly in the 1970s when things happened with great rapidity and one crisis after another, and I was up to my arms in alligators and just surviving from day to day. Thank God I was young enough to make it through all of that then. I didn't see any patterns to my work. It was just one thing after another. But in going back and reflecting and pulling research together and making notes, I began to see that how that there was a pattern, that one thing often did lead to another. Our ability to get into one thing prepared us for another thing, or I was exposed by some experience or my contact with some people with a set of information or a set of experiences. And I could see how a lot of things that I got into were not things I could have plunged into immediately. They all had a background, and that they built up to the things I ultimately did. And so it was sort of therapeutic for me to find that there was some sense to my life, that it did lead somewhere. And I also, in some cases, came to different conclusions than I had held at the time the events occurred. For instance, I went into the oral histories in the Sierra Club Library and learned after the great events and the great controversy in the late 60s, I saw what the different participants said and what their aims were. Even a decade later, some of them were extremely angry. There was this great falling out between people like Dave Brower on one hand, my predecessor, and Ansel Adams on the other hand, the great photographer who had been climbing buddies in the late 1920s, and they were now intensely angry at each other. I was sort of in the middle of all of that, trying to avoid the light of fire, and it was rather intense. Polly Dyer, sitting there, was on the board of directors during the 1960s, and Dick Fiddler was at a later time, but they both know something about the intensity of feeling during that time. But the point I wanted to make was that, for instance, the emergence in 1970 of the Sierra Club as an environmental organization was not something that could have been automatically assumed to have occurred. And I think it occurred primarily because both I, as executive director, wanted it to occur, but also the volunteer president of the Sierra Club at that time, Phil Berry, wanted it to occur. But many other national conservation, online conservation organizations, didn't have two people at the top who did want it to occur. Some were slow to make the transition, some never made the transition, like the Isaac Walton League never made the transition and never grew and never became a different organization. And this, so I recount this in the book. Incidentally, my daughter and husband have just come in. It's good to see you. So the book does deal with some of these different conclusions that I came to with the passage of time and looking back into the record. Now, I thought I would actually read a few passages from the book to give you a little flavor of what it's like, and then following that, I'll be happy to entertain questions. And following that, for those of you who wish to buy the book, they've got a nice quantity back there, and I'd be glad to sign them and dedicate them. First, let me change the order here. Let me first read a passage about the Wilderness Bill. The year is 1963. The campaign began in 1955, and it progressed for a while. The bill passed the Senate, but was stuck in the House of Representatives. Let me turn my attention. I'm sorry to bury my nose in this, but my glasses are, my eyes are such that I have to do it this way. The bill faced an apparently immovable object. The obdurate chairman of the Interior Committee of the House of Representatives, Representative Wayne Aspinall, who represented the western part of Colorado, the part west of the Continental Divide. He had been responding sympathetically to opposition from constituents such as ranchers, miners, and irrigators by refusing to let the bill out of his committee. My assignment was to organize enough support in his district to induce him to change his mind. I was joined in this work by Bill Reevely of the National Wildlife Federation. He and I met in Grand Junction and decided to split the district between us. He took the northern half and I the southern half. I checked with people I knew in the Colorado Mountain Club in Denver, but unfortunately they couldn't tell me of any people to contact in western Colorado. Neither, it seemed, could anyone else. There was then no Sierra Club organization in Colorado, nor were there any other statewide conservation groups to call upon for help. I was on my own. After renting a car at the airport, I decided to drop by a sporting goods store in Grand Junction to learn what I could about the region. I asked a clerk of the store who around there might care about wilderness. Well, he replied, the packers and guides did. They made their living by taking hunters into wilderness areas. When I asked how I could find out about them, he provided me with a list published by the game department. It had everything I needed, names, addresses, and phone numbers. So I drove south on Highway 50 toward places such as Montrose, Ridgeway, and Ouray, looking up each packer. I met packers in their corrals and kitchens and asked which wildernesses they used and how. Then I told them that the future of these areas was not secure and that we were trying to get better protection for them. I let them know that their congressman needed to hear their views because he was standing in the way. Most of them were interested and eager to help. I would take down their words and send a telegram if they would tell me what they wanted to say. I had them sign what they dictated, and most of them even gave me 75 cents to send the wires. Then I went into the nearest town with the telegraph office and sent off their messages to Aspinall in Washington, D.C. As the days passed, dozens of telegrams poured into Aspinall's office. He could almost plot the path of my travel by the source of these wires. He was hearing from real live constituents, in their own words, people in western Colorado who wanted the Wilderness Act passed. But he complained bitterly to the press about outside agitators being sent into his district. That was me. And really. But before long, a compromise was struck. He would get the provisions he sought in the study of public land law, and Congress would have to act affirmatively to put areas into the wilderness system. He then let the bill out of his committee, and it became law the following year. I'm sure that the unexpected voices from his district played no small part in his success. So that's the first story. Now let's do a little bit about the North Cascades. In the early 60s, when I was a field organizer up here, my boss told me one of my jobs was to work with the local conservation leaders to get a North Cascades National Park enacted. So we had many consultations, and I'll begin to read a section. For the North Cascades, the question then was, what kind of national park did we want? I generally advised my clients, and at that time I was on retainer, to come up with specific proposals, so that legislators could reassess what you had in mind. I was taught in my government courses in college that to be an effective lobbyist, you needed to know exactly what you wanted, who could give it to you, and how they were influenced and made decisions. This was the thinking behind the technique that I had developed for studying wilderness reclassifications. After I persuaded leaders in the N3C and the Mountaineers that this was so, they turned to me to figure out how to develop such a proposal. While I did sample this area and drove the surrounding roads, The region was too vast for me to know enough to draw the boundaries. Instead, I picked the brains of the climbers, backpackers, and mountain photographers who had gotten to know the various parts of the area quite well over the years. People such as John Worth of Seattle and Chuck Hesse of Yakima were invaluable in giving me this kind of information. I asked each person where the most valuable areas were that should be saved in a park. We got the people to sketch out their ideas and maps for the various sectors. I pressed them, too, to give me the reasoning behind their ideas. And gradually, I pieced together all the information and boundaries emerged from their collective judgments. Then I searched out every piece of information I could find about competing values. I went to state agencies to learn about mining and minerals and water resources. I got detailed maps from the Forest Service showing types of forests, including prime timber stands. And I got transportation maps showing projected road extensions. I wanted to know what the arguments would be, what arguments would be made against including a given area in the park and how well-founded they were. After I evaluated these competing values, I put together what I felt was a defensible proposal for a new national park of 1.3 million acres. It also involved a complementary national recreation area around Lake Chelan on the east, which was no longer entirely natural since its lake level had been raised by a small dam and a small community was located at its head. I called this a prospectus for a North Cascades National Park. My report ran to 130 pages and was endorsed by my client organizations. Published in 1963, it was distributed to federal agencies, the media, and political leaders. Senator Henry Jackson of Washington State responded with interest and induced the administration of President John Kennedy to set up a process to study the idea. The group, composed of a team of officials from federal natural resource agencies, held administrative hearings, and I helped turn out our supporters to attend them. Eventually, this team, by the narrowest of margins, did recommend establishment of a new national park in the North Cascades region, but a much smaller one that embraced only the northern portion of the area. The North Cascades campaign continued for a number of years after I left the Northwest, which was 1965 when I got hired to go to California. And my successors, especially Brock Evans, worked energetically for the park that we backed. Finally, in 1968, a North Cascades National Park was established along with flanking national recreation areas. All told, 684,000 acres were transferred to the National Park Service. This was short of the 1.3 million acres that we wanted. In the ensuing years, however, battling by our folks continued to expand the boundaries of the Glacier Peak Wilderness Area and brought protection to other nearby areas. Eventually, Evans told me, every single acre that was included in my 1963 prospectus got statutory protection under one designation or another. So that's a little bit about the role I had in that. And finally, let me read a little short passage from my treatment of the Redwood National Park, though a little prefatory comment is needed for it. This was a campaign that ran from 1964 to 1968 in its first iteration. And it was different from the North Cascades battle and many others in that we were dealing with private lumber company lands. And so they were logging these lands as we talked about the issue, as Congress debated it. The trees were going down. They were going down more and more. New roads were being punched in. We no sooner identify some marvelous grove or area, then they'd go in to log it. So it was a crisis situation. And so, working with Senator Jackson, we conceived the idea of a declaration of immediate taking. That is, when the Congress passed the bill and when the President signed it, the moment he lifted his pen off the paper, I have one of his pens that he used at home, and I was there, that land moved into federal hands. It no longer was private property. And that leads up to the little passage I want to read. A few days after the President signed the Redwood Spill, I traveled to the park to celebrate with local supporters. As we gloried in the trees along Lost Man Creek that had been saved, we were accosted by the chief forester for the Arcata Redwood Company, Gene Hofstad, who roared up in his jeep to accuse us of trespassing, ordering us off their land. We had the pleasure of replying, "This land is now part of the Redwood National Park. It is you who don't belong here anymore." A delicious moment. And I put an end to all of that. And that also brings an end to my presentation, and I'd be glad to entertain any questions you'd like to have. I'm delighted for you to come back and have me sign the books if you.
I have a question, but I think you ought to talk about Mike was the one who drew the boundaries for the Alpine Lake Wilderness. You know, big discussion between wilderness and the recreation area.
Well, I did that too.
Yeah, we did that too. I still have my copy. No, my copy's in the library now. Okay.
Well, once again, I picked the brains of all the people that knew the area, and there's a passage in the book about that. And obviously, even more work was done by many other fine people in later years. But once again, I sort of kicked off the process and got it into play. I might say that my role for a number of Forest Service, there were then some of them limited areas, some primitive areas, was that I was sort of trying to salvage damaged goods. When I came on the scene in the early 60s, the Forest Service had been in midstream in a process of doing away with what were then called limited areas. They were only found here in the Northwest. There had been a number of them, and over half had been already dispensed with. And I was trying to slow that process. Particularly, and then some of the primitive areas too were full of so many checkerboard holdings, and Alpine Lakes had an awful lot of them. The Idaho primitive area in Idaho was burdened with all sorts of mining claims and stub roads that went into them and airfields. And so the Forest Service and some of the resource exploiters all had the grand plan that they were so damaged that the areas ought to be done away with. So the plans for a while for some of these that I helped put together were designed to create some plausibility for the idea that wilderness was possible, that you could trade away and trade out of some of the checkerboard in holdings, or you could buy them. The same with mining claims, and that some of them could be invalidated. That there were various techniques to remedy the flaws and bring them back and make them something better again. So that was some of the role I played. And there's a treatment in the book of some later questions about whether I thought expansively enough. But at the time, we were just trying to hold on to something, and later people got very ambitious and did some great things. Yes?
I'm assuming that you're probably still a supporter of the Sierra Club, but I'm wondering what other organizations you really respect that, you know, maybe some that I haven't heard of. I I think as a family, we, you know, we have a very small amount of money that we'd like to give, particularly to, you know, the organizations that most need it, even at a grassroots level. So I'm kind of trying to learn more about other organizations.
Well, let me say in a preparatory way that I deal with this in the book, that I think sometime in the mid-80s, the environmental movement sort of split, it, broadly speaking, into three camps, a mainstream camp, a radical camp, and a conservative camp, and Sierra Club is in the mainstream camp, so it's moved a bit to the left in that camp. And some groups in the radical camp, like Greenpeace, have moved closer to the Sierra Club and become more pragmatic. And I could get into those distinctions if you wanted to, but I feel a kinship with most of the pragmatic groups that are in the mainstream, and Wilderness Society has always been closest to the Sierra Club, but NRDC has been too since it came into an existence. At times we've found some differences with NRDC, but right now, yes, we're very close to them again. So I suppose those are the two groups that are closest to the Sierra Club. A very different kind of group whose work I think is very effective and I respect a great deal is the Rainforest Action Network. And they've organized some splendid consumer boycotts and other pressure techniques to have businesses shape up and stop doing destructive things. So I think there's a place for that too, particularly during hard political times. And there are all sorts of great regional and local groups all across the country.
Well, Mike, as when you took over the executive directorship of the club after the Brower years, it struck me that what the club really needed at that time was a unifier, and it may have been your curse that you were a unifier, because to do that, you couldn't actually be the conservation director and the executive director at the same time. You had to keep your own counsel a lot. You had to listen to a lot of nonsense and nod your head wisely, and it seemed to be a pretty lonely job sometimes, being the great unifier when everybody else was heading in all directions. And I wondered if that was your perception or how you look at those years now.
Well, it was a very trying process going through those controversial years in the late 60s. I think both factions sort of secretly thought I probably sided with them. And I was caught in a position where I worked for, my boss was Dave Brower, and I wanted him, and I thought it was proper to have a unified staff structure. When I first went down there, I discovered the job they gave me as assistant to the president was designed to set up a rivalry between the president of the club and the executive director, and I was going to be the person who built up the capacity of the president to play that role. And I, after a year in that role, I said, this is a losing proposition. This is going to be bad for the organization. And Brower was spending most of his time in New York working on books, and the conservation work wasn't getting enough attention, and the president of the club or the various presidents were trying to pick up the pieces. So I came to the conclusion is, folks, what you needed is a conservation department, a staff structure designed to support all the players we had at the time, whether they were the executive director or various presidents or other volunteers and leaders who were trying to run campaigns, that you'd work for them all. So they said, fine, that sounds good. Now why don't you do it? So I said, all right. So in 1966, I did become the conservation director, but I was acutely conscious of the fact that I worked for Brower, but I also worked for the board, and I was serving a lot of different volunteers, and I didn't want them to be, you know, trying to manipulate me, and I tried to sort of stand aside from the fray. And at times I think they were trying to draw me in, but then after a while I think the battling got so intense. Let me just give you a feeling, Brian. You were at some of those meetings.
I went down especially for one of them.
Yeah, I mean, they'd have these board meetings in downtown San Francisco hotels, and there'd be crowds of people, or a couple hundred people, split between the adherents of one side or the other, and they'd be shouting and applauding and stomping and waving their hands in support of whichever speaker they agreed with. And people were bringing indictments against and charges of all sorts of misbehavior against my boss. And then the presidents of the club were getting me to advise them on how to keep order in these meetings. And I was helping to write press releases to support my boss and saying that the board still had confidence in him. And I thought to myself, somebody needs to survive this process. And after a while, I think people began to kind of ease up and to lay off trying to draw me into their ranks. And then, but there was, after the issue was resolved, and there, you know, were two factions that went to the membership in a big contested vote in 1969, spring of 1969, and they were organized like political parties, and the members of them were campaigning all over the country in chapter meetings and making mass mailings, and it was very intense. And the Ansel Adams faction won overwhelmingly, and the Brower faction lost, and I was asked to be acting executive director during the spring when that occurred, and then suddenly I was made chief of staff. I think the winning CMC faction was not really sure that they wanted an executive director. In their minds, that position was so indelibly associated with Brower, who the winning faction thought was their adversary, that it was a while before they finally decided that they did want an executive director. It was a while more before they decided that they wanted him to have any of the normal powers. It was a while before they decided that they wanted anybody else to be conservation director. For a while they thought maybe I would just go back to doing that and they would dispense with an executive director. So I ended up being a conservation director as well as executive director for a full decade. I mean, it was late 70s before I was able to hire Doug Scott, in fact, conservation director. So there was a long overhang of the bad feelings from the 60s into the 70s.
What was the issue between Adams and Brower that caused such a rift?
Well, I have a little chapter in the book, and there were many ingredients to it, and basically in the book I have pretty much laid out what the two sides said. In the campaign in 1969, the Adams faction thought alleged that the survival of the organization was at stake, alleged that the organization was virtually bankrupt, that if Brower was defying the board's directions constantly, was spending too much on the books, that the organization's capital was all being bled off on them. They didn't object really to the kinds of conservation campaigns he and I were running. No, but at the later, the oral interviews, which are bound and are there on record, do reveal that there were some prominent former Sierra Club officials that really did want to go back to the old Sierra Club. You know, at one time, the Sierra Club was in a sort of an exclusive organization. When I joined, in fact, and probably too, you had to have two active members vouch for you as a suitable companion on the trail. And there were various bouts of exclusionary activities, excluding certain types of people. And it was not a good scene. So Brower was part of the transition away from that kind of organization, and I certainly believed in that. And after a while, the staff were just routinely signing the endorsements, and the organization began to grow. Though, you know, when I started, it had 16,000 members. When I retired, it was going on 700,000 members. So, though I think, well, this wasn't exactly your question, but it's worth pointing out that in a few years between the late 60s and the early 70s, the Sierra Club went through a series of jarring transitions. It went from being an outdoor club with a conservation interest to being a conservation organization with an outdoor program. And then it went from being a California organization to being a national organization. And it went from being a conservation organization to being an environmental organization, and conservation being concerned with protecting and preserving the natural endowment of the earth, while environment went beyond that to include, you know, pollution control and global warming and things of that sort. And in looking back upon it, that was had to be traumatic for any organization, well-established old-line organization dating back to 1892, to be undergoing such remarkable change in such a short period. And I think in many ways, standing back and with the benefit of hindsight, that controversy reflected to some extent the catharsis of the organization over all that change. It got projected onto one individual as sort of the epitome of stresses and strains over that change, and he made his own contributions to the problems. But I think that, and it would be unfair to say the issue was all about that, but I think it did serve as a kind of a purging of the pent-up frustrations over the change. And the Brownerites, going back to your question, did feel that it was all about backsliding versus going forward. Let me say that, you know, there's this book, Bowling Alone, by this sociologist at Harvard, Robert Putnam, but he, looking at many voluntary organizations in the United States over recent decades, shows that most organizations formed around the turn of the last century, the Sierra Club was formed in that period, started going into decline in terms of their vigor and their membership, their finances around 1970. Some a little earlier, some a little later. This includes some churches, and it includes, significantly fraternal groups such as the Masonic Order and others, Elks, and it includes a lot of organizations. And it's a great puzzle as to why this massive decline has occurred. He offers all sorts of solutions or explanations, possibly, and he isn't sure of any of them. But it's my thesis, and I do believe it, that it is probably because the Sierra Club did reinvent itself so thoroughly around 1970 that it survived and is flourished. It essentially became a new organization with old roots. It had only a bare resemblance by the 1980s to the organization that existed, say, 40 years before.
Well, Mike, by keeping the peace at the top during those years afterwards, I think you enabled thousands of other people to do a lot of fantastic work, and we are enormously grateful.
Well, thank you, Dan. I appreciate those comments. Yeah, yes?
It sounds like there's been a lot of significant successes, but a lot of struggles over a long period of time. My question is, what gave you the staying power?
Well, partly it was because did all of you hear that question? Partly it was because I was young enough. I don't think I had the stamina anymore to put up with that kind of stress and strain. There was certainly a deep commitment to the cause, and this was an important the work that we were doing. But I also think it was because, and this is in the book, that when I grew up and went through my college years, I hadn't conceived of getting into this kind of work. And I did my undergraduate work in political science, and after a tour in the Army, I got a law degree. And I thought I'd become a practicing politician, frankly. And I did a lot of things that anybody going into politics would do. But being a lawyer and being in politics means that you deal with controversy as an everyday thing. And so I sort of steeled myself, well, this is to the reality that this is what I'll be dealing with during my lifetime, and this is the kind of thing I knew. Political organizations are always racked by contention and rivalries and factions, and so I said, well, this is just the kind of thing I signed on for. It was a pretty bad case of it. And I must say that some of the things I learned during those years in student politics and other things were bad habits that I later came to realize were not the things I wanted to do anymore. So I was glad that I finally, and I did run for public office once in Oregon for the legislature and didn't get elected, but first time out, did reasonably well. In fact, led the ticket in one part of the county. But it came to me that I don't want to be talking about all these issues that don't interest me. I'm interested in conservation, and that's what I ought to be doing. And so I kind of went through a change in the direction of the career that I wanted. Ready?
Of all the national environmental organizations, it seems that the Sierra Club is the most politically active. You know, to really get involved in endorsing candidates and working for them and things. And I wondered how that all came about, why you went on that path. Did it have something to do with it?
The question was how the Sierra Club did get into electoral politics. I have that in the book, but I'll tell you, in the late 1970s, I happened to be doing some lobbying in Congress, and I went into the office of Senator John Culver, a Democrat from Iowa. And he was a solid supporter of the environmental cause, and I went in to strategize about something, and he just stopped me before I got too much into my spiel. He said, you know, you folks are always coming in here wanting something of me. But, you know, I'm in a big election campaign now. I'm in this for my political life. He says, I need something of you. You know, this has got to be a two-way street. If you let people like me disappear from Congress, you're going to wake up one morning and not have hardly any friends left here anymore. And indeed, he was defeated in the next election. And we didn't do anything to help him. But I brought back to the club's board of directors what he said. And I said, you know, I think he's absolutely right. You go through a progression of thinking that you're outdoors people, you love the outdoors, you love certain forests, you love certain animals, you love the various special places, and then you try to figure out how to do something to keep them in existence. And often, though not always, but often you have to go to public officials. And then you have to face who are the public officials, particularly the elected ones. Well, they have to be elected. And you can lobby them if they're there, but if they're not there, then you've got to be concerned with how to get them there. And you've got to come to grips with the whole political process. And that's not always what a lot of, you know, people who love the outdoors want to spend their time doing. But if the love is deep enough, you've got to come to grips with the entire process. So the Sierra Club decided to set up a political action committee and had its lawyers advise it about what legally it could do, and it found out it could do more than it thought it could do. There had been some recent changes in the law, and we started a program that eventually blossomed. We set up various safeguards, and Dick knows a lot about this, that you needed to have a two-thirds majority in the local Sierra Club operation, and then we had a national oversight committee that also had to agree by that same degree, and we thought that would sort of prevent unrestrained partisanship. We wanted to make sure people were looking at things accurately and from a national perspective. So there are various safeguards we put into place, but by the early 80s, we were getting heavily involved in congressional campaigns and started endorsing hundreds of candidates for Congress and enjoyed some measure of success. Today, we're spending a lot more of our time on just getting people registered to vote, getting the vote out, and we're working as part of large coalitions that are working to that effect. My personal belief is that we've got to get back to doing more what are called independent expenditure campaigns, where we target particularly races that where we think we might have the ability to tip things in our way by intervening and raising money especially for that purpose. And for a while, a number of years ago, we were having some pretty good success with it, and I'd like to see us get back to it. So I think we've got the most terrible politics right now in my memory, where we have both the Congress in hostile hands and the presidency, and we're in greater peril than we've ever been. Yes?
I was going to kind of build on that too, just because in a couple of the previous answers to questions, like state power and the challenges politically now, just with your experience and successes and the passion that you've had in the past, looking at what we're faced with now, what are, I guess, one part, just looking back, is there, you just kind of mentioned how this is probably the worst or that you've seen. I was curious if, you know, how they say history repeats itself, if you could compare it to a time and challenges in the past and what helped make it successful then. And then just because this one's different, looking forward, what are some things that you'd really like to see, you know, kind of?
Well, just in terms of technique, and you can get into the program if you want, but when I began 45 years ago, I first met people like Polly in the late 1950s at Federation of Western Outdoor Club convention. So, but in the early 60s when I began, we were operating in a pretty hostile climate then, too. Many of our folks felt very embattled, very alone. I would travel from one community to another in places like Wenatchee and Yakima and so forth, and people felt like heretics in their own community, and we'd meet in people's homes and church basements and so forth, and I'd pass along information about successes and successful approaches I'd heard in other communities, and they'd tell me the good and bad stories from their own experience, and pretty soon, like a circuit rider, I began to sort of spread the word about things that seemed to be more promising. But we were then doing, as you heard in my story about Aspinall's district, grassroots organizing. We were out there knocking on doors, going into fields and corrals and kitchens and bars. I, on a number of occasions, went in and chatted with folks in bars, and I guess I didn't look like some typical bar aficionado, but nonetheless, I was able to do it and would learn things. I remember, for instance, I went into a bar in Colorado in the mountains, was just chatting one evening. I had sort of run out through my list of packers and guys, and I said, I got just chatting about the neat country around here. You ever go into it? And bartender told me, he says, you know, finally we turned out to be very sympathetic. And I said, I was going to the next town, which is Durango, and he said, oh, go see the owner of the Turner Industrial Bank. He really believes in what you guys believe in. And so I went down there the next day and got an appointment with him, and he was just overjoyed to see me. He said, let's go around. I know the people you ought to see. And so he introduced me to other people. Pretty soon I was all over town meeting people and getting telegrams. And pretty soon they said, oh, in the next town over by that reservoir, go see that guy. He'll take you around, introduce you to more people. And it all came from chatting at a bar. You know, as I said, nobody had any names to give me. Nobody knew anybody over there at that time. I think it's that kind of thing, and I think my personal feeling is that technology is fine, but there's nothing like human relations, nothing like one-on-one relations. I think we have to do more of that. We have to talk to people personally. We have to nurture relationships over a long period of time. Paulie and I have known each other for 50 years and kept in touch. And I think it's that kind of shoe leather, grassroots work that ultimately pays big dividends. And I think we can make the best of new tools like the internet and so forth, but cell phones and all those things. But I think we've, at least those who are trying to do the kind of work that I once did, need to do more of that kind of grassroots work. I think we need to pick our targets more strategically, picking campaigns that are winnable, even though they may have challenges, but that not picking them sort of willy-nilly. There's a whole set of criteria, but that's important because, well, when it leads to success, people feel encouraged that their hard work pays off. And then you attract more people who are willing to put in hard work and devote years to it when they see that it gets somewhere. One of the great problems of these times is that people are not able to sort out what's productive and what isn't. I mean, everybody's butting their head against the wall, and everybody's has a similar story of frustration to tell, but they can't tell what might be productive and what isn't productive. And they aren't. I was blessed by getting sort of positive reinforcement from the real world of sort of political combat. And in some ways, those lessons aren't as readily available anymore during hard political times. I also would say, though, on the larger sense, that nature of politics has undergone a change. My time, it used to be organized primarily around economic issues, and today it's organized primarily around cultural issues. And one of the, I'm sure you can all recite many of those cultural issues, but one of the implications of that change is that when we were dealing with economic issues, there were many matters of degree, and people, some legislators weren't sure where they stood on some issues, so it was a lot more lobbyable. There was a lot more loose action in the system. Now that the cultural issues predominate, people on both sides regard them as right or wrong type issues, moral issues. We certainly believe some of our environmental issues, like endangered species, involve ethical and moral issues, but issues are much less lobbyable before legislative bodies today because of the overlay of these cultural issues, which have people much more polarized and feeling much more antagonistic toward each other. So I think that something has to be done to start to de-emphasize those kinds of polarizing issues. And I'm probably not of the right generation to know anything about how to do that, but I believe that that kind of politics is very poisonous. And I don't think it's healthy for the country either. Some of the issues, let's just take a simple one, like flag burning. It's not a real issue. And it doesn't have much significance for the country. It's, in many ways, it's a concocted issue. It's a way of, what he used to say after the Civil War, waving the bloody flag and getting emotions churned up. I think people, no matter where they are in the political spectrum, are pretty much all patriotic. But waving that bloody flag just excites passions and creates disbelief that others aren't patriotic or they don't respect the flag. So I think that we ought to encourage our candidates, you know, to not get involved in phony issues of that sort and to frame things in terms that have meaning for people's lives. And not to talk technical jargon, but to talk down to earth in straightforward ways that communicate and talk about values and things that people can make sense of in a day when they're overloaded with information. And that's just part of my little list of what I think might help, but I think younger people are going to have to figure out how we fight our way out of this.
But yes. Yeah. My impression is recent, there have been lots of contention in recent Sierra Club elections for board of directors, and I'm not quite clear about this. I know there have been talks about there have been factions like the John Muir group or something, and controversies about immigrants and use of some money or whatnot. So what are the contentious issues now within the Sierra Club?
Well, let me first put this in context and then I'll address your question. One thing I never foresaw that when I helped lead the Sierra Club into a more and more political environment involved in more and more issues on a national level was that in a way it would become public property. We're part of the political fabric of the country. And that has led to a series of people who are obsessed about certain issues trying to take over the board of directors, very frankly, hostile takeovers. And when you add to that the fact that the movement has become sort of split between various camps, to people, for instance, in the radical camp that would be happy to take over the board. And the Sierra Club's organized in California, always has been, which has very liberal nonprofit laws governing nonprofits, which allow a very small number of people to sign petitions and run candidates for the board of directors. And so there have been a series of factions. I think we're now working our way about through the third wave of them. They're about different issues. What the John Muir Sierras you were mentioning were people who basically didn't want to see any resource exploitation or development of any kind occur. And the dominant group in the organization think, you know, review, we want to see an awful lot saved, but we're not trying to stop the world and stop everything. You know, some people believe we are. And so that faction for a while ran petition candidates one after another and organized itself as a little political party within the organization and, being unopposed, kept electing them against those who were nominated by the official nominating committee. And these were people who'd worked their way up through the ranks from their chapters through national committee structures and had learned a lot about the organization and had proven their allegiance to it, whereas these petition candidates often were people who weren't even members. They only joined the organization when they were enlisted by this faction to do it, and then they only joined maybe the January before the election. They're people who had no experience in the organization. And suddenly, some of them had names in other organizations. They were getting elected. Well, finally, and I say thank God, some of the longtime leaders in the organization say, we can't sit here being a punching bag for one hostile takeover after another. We've got to, you know, unfortunate though it may be, we've got to organize a counteracting group to try to defend the organization from hostile takeovers. It used to be the elections were kind of colorless affairs where it was not good form for any of the candidates to talk about what it was really about. They just say, I've done a lot of these nice things, working my way up, and please vote for me. And get a nice shot of a picture of you in the outdoors with your hiking clothes on. That would be, that might elect you. But now we have some of the politics very candidly revealed in this literature, and I'm somewhat, or try to be somewhat philosophical about it. I think it's just because we are part of the landscape of politics in America now that groups try to take over an organization with a lot of resources and assets. And the latest one was about immigration. Some of the leadership, and that included me sometime back, felt that the organization had people who were thoroughly devoted to the cause on both sides of the issue. Some could make good cases for controlling immigration. Others would make the case that, this wasn't about population control or the same number of people on the globe, regardless of whether their foot's on one side of the border or the other. And you needed to, if you're going to do population control, and the club believes in that, you need to do it on a planetary basis. But the basic analysis that we came up with was that we're just too split on the issue to be effective. And to be effective, you need to have some high degree of agreement within the organization, or you spend all of your time just fussing over the issue rather than doing anything about it. So that was what the board of directors decided, and people who want us to be active in pushing for controlling immigration have been running petition candidates for a couple of years now. But with the other side finally shaking off its lethargy and organizing to defend the organization, those hostile takeovers have stopped for a couple of years. There's some who hope that they can, return to their gardens and stop having to engage in this kind of political combat. But I have no illusions that this is going to stop. We have a record now of over a dozen years of these hostile takeovers being tried, and I think it'll probably continue. Though at least it's now a competitive contest and not a one-sided affair. But that's just a personal view. That's not the official Sierra Club view. I'm no longer working for them, so I can say what I think. Yes?
Could you say a few words about international experience, if there is any, for the Sierra Club?
The Sierra Club's had an international program since the early 1970s, and when I changed my jobs from being executive director to chairman, and then later moved to Washington, D.C., I became very, very active in it. I was not the director of the program, but I was a sort of international ambassador for the organization, and we worked on a lot of international issues. Basically, in the recent decades, we've tried to influence the policy and program of the United States government as it deals with the international environmental issues. And when the politics was better, we had some considerable success. I myself conceived the idea that USAID should not make grants for any projects that abroad that damaged areas that either were protected as national parks and things of that sort, or should be, and it had any status under which they were being studied for that purpose. I later led a campaign to keep oil drilling out of an area that was had been part of a national park in Ecuador, though the area was neatly excised out of it at midnight before the leases were granted, and we had more lawsuits to contest that, and some of that's in the book too. I had a number of other experiences, but I will say that one disappointment that I had that deals with the Sierra Club internationally is that the Sierra Club's organized in Canada as well as the United States, but that happened somewhat accidentally. Shortly after Earth Day back in 1970, people up there who were members decided they wanted to be organized, and they just went ahead and did it. They didn't ask for permission. And suddenly our lawyers got busy and reserved our name in various provinces, but it sort of was, we were faced with fait accompli. But my predecessor had organized a Sierra Club in the United Kingdom, and I went over in the early 70s and spoke to a conference in the Midlands that had about 200 people there, organized by the Sierra Club of Britain. And there were big signs on the outside of the building, the Sierra Club of the UK, and so on. And I went around and visited members and leaders throughout the country. We had a bank account, and we had offices in London, even had some staff. And I saw us developing a series of foreign affiliates. But lo and behold, I was crushed that the leadership of the club never believed that this should happen. Even this new international committee had the notion that we would be treated as terrible carpetbaggers and deeply resented. And I tried to point out, well, look, every good idea has originated somewhere, and those people live somewhere, and they're in one country or another, and lots of ideas, good ideas, have spread throughout the world and embraced in many nations. And why should we suddenly be an idea that doesn't deserve to have a future abroad? And people, particularly in English-speaking countries, kept writing me saying, "I mean, Australia, I'd like to organize a Sierra Club, or New Zealand." Ultimately, I think there were people in 23 nations abroad that wanted to organize their own domestic Sierra Clubs, and they weren't all English-speaking countries. There were countries as diverse as Colombia, Nigeria, all sorts of places. And yet, I had to tell them no. The board of directors said no. I had to close down the Sierra Club of the United Kingdom Limited, and it ceased to exist. Well, other organizations from abroad flourished. They're like Friends of the Earth, which my predecessor began. And, you know, groups like World Wildlife Fund started in South Africa. Greenpeace was an offshoot in British Columbia, the Sierra Club, and spread throughout the world. I just never could understand the logic behind it. I knew there were some reasons they had. They didn't want financial. They were worried there'd be a financial drain on the main organization, and there were questions about liability abroad and so forth. So there was some reason behind it, but all of those reasons had been addressed and overcome by the other organizations that spread throughout the world. The Sierra Club never elected to do so. And I personally felt it was tragic. I remember I went to Sweden and Mexico, meeting with club members there and other environmentalists, and was ready carrying my field organizing from here abroad. I was beginning to get people organized to want to do something, but it never came to anything. Yes,
I'd like to make a comment on that. Your history is very great. But when the Pacific Northwest chapter, the original one, now a lot of others, organized in mid-1953,
yes.
Johnny Dyer was the one who suggested including British Columbia and Alberta, even though there were no members there, with the idea that if anything came up, we could speak for them. That was in the list, as I recall, with the board to authorize in the Pacific Northwest chapter. And they didn't object at that time. So it's just a little piece of history.
Well, that's a good piece of history. I didn't know
that. I'll have to tell John about the rest of the history that came out of that. But anyhow, there was, when the British Columbia Group went into business, they had the authority because the club overall had not objected to British Columbia and Alberta being part of the chapter of the Pacific.
Well, and a later little footnote on that same point is, as late as 1971, the Sierra Club Council called for a process for organizing abroad, but all of that collapsed, and I recount in greater detail in the book, but it's one of the disappointments. I suppose we've probably gone on long enough, and I'd like to thank you again. And
thank you very much.
Go over and see if we can find some more. Thank you.